This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
For those of you not familiar, Def Leppard. Spit it up, but no chance if you don't want to die. You like a four little words when you spit it up, but then you won't cause you know that you can. You got it. But are you getting it? Are you getting it? Then somehow they turn that to Armageddon. It. Here it comes. Hold on. All right, enough of that. Joining me from the great state of Alabama is Luke. You've heard about him, and now you're going to get a chance to meet him. So, Luke, son of Libby, good morning. How are you?
Hey, Mac, doing great. It's a real honor to be on All Marine Radio.
Oh, come on, man. First of all, it was awesome meeting you and Emma. We didn't get a chance to meet Libby when we were in Alabama, but and the weather sucked, man. It was raining. It was raining, like soaking wet, like east, southeast, heavy, disgusting rain. It was pouring like cats and dogs. Not when we got there, but when we tried to get in the restaurant. And then the parking lot was flooded, so sloshing through the parking lot, getting soaking wet. And then, I don't know if you know this, but then the gunner and I wound up spending about an hour at a gas station as we were leaving town with three cops talking about what they did, talking about PTSD and stuff like that. So it was quite the night in Huntsville, Alabama. So thanks for hanging out.
Yeah, man, glad you guys got to come through. And that's pretty awesome. Yeah, that stop out there in Gurley with those police officers. That's really cool.
So we need to find out about you. Born and raised where?
Here in Huntsville, North Central Alabama.
North Central Alabama. All right. Auburn or Alabama?
Roll Tide.
Roll Tide. So do you guys just expect, like, the national championship belongs to you, and if we don't win it, it's like a letdown? Is that how that works now?
That's the way it is these days, that's for sure. But we deserve it after so many years of sucking. So
the Nick Saban, any doubt in anybody's mind that if he ran for governor or emperor of Alabama that he would win?
Hands down. Not even close.
the hands down. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar? So you've grown up in Huntsville, right? And for those of you who don't know, Huntsville's prominent because it's like Rocket City, man. Rocket City. So you grow up in the midst of all these rockets. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
I always knew I wanted to be in the military as a kid. Wasn't really sure what branch. I had a great uncle who was a B-17 pilot who was shot down and killed in World War II. And that always kind of, you know, always felt a lot of pride to know that he was a bomber pilot. I thought that was really cool. So the military had always been on my radar. But I was given a book by a friend's dad, nonfiction, but fictional, you know, characters type
right,
book
right.
In high school. This book series called The Core by W.E.B. Griffin.
How many books are there in that series?
I think there's 10. I'm looking over at it right now. I believe it's 10. But yeah, and I got like the ninth one when he handed it to me. It was on a hockey trip. And he saw me reading the book, and he's like, here, check this one out. And it was like the ninth book of the series, and I just ate it up. And, you know, when I got home, I just, you know, went out and bought them and started reading them. And it's just something about the way the in that book, how the Marines seem to associate with one another and, the steep tradition and all that. It just kind of hooked me.
you know, if you don't, you didn't really have to buy them because they were all over the Marine Corps. All you had to do was kind of like walk into, I don't know, a common area and look around and like, oh, there's another one. Let me wait till nobody's, let me wait till nobody's looking. I'll snag that. The, because they're everywhere. So that kind of got you hooked on the Marine Corps when you tell me about being recruited. Were you only interested in the Marine Corps? Did you talk to everybody?
No, I didn't. It was only the Marines. I think, you know, 9/11 happened. I think I was a sophomore in high school, and, you know, a lot of me and my friends were kind of looking around like, you know, well, we need to join something. And I think after I started reading that book series, I think when I was a freshman and probably when I was about 14 or so, I think I was just, you know, I definitely was thinking, you know, I want to be a Marine. And then when 9/11 happened, that just secured it. Just talked to the recruiter. I wanted to, my family had a motorcycle racing team at the time, and I wanted to be able to keep doing that after high school with them some. So I thought the reserves was my best option. And I was lucky enough to have a infantry unit a couple hours up the road.
So you walk in and you say, I want to join the Marine Corps today. You like demand to enlist, yes?
Yeah, you said I need to come back to my parents when I'm 16. But so we did that. And I remember my dad was at work. He's a pilot, and I think he had to. I don't remember exactly how this went down, but I guess I just, you know, couldn't wait till he came home from work, because I remember he had to go to a reserve center in whatever city he was in so he could sign the paperwork so they could fax it over. But so I guess I had to join on my birthday. I don't really remember exactly how it went down, but that sounds about right.
Wow. So, and then you joined, did you get any kind of guaranteed MOS or any kind of guaranteed training, or did you?
Yeah, at least I'm not real sure how it works, you know, joining active, but in the reserves, you're kind of beholden to what MOSs are around you. And the local unit here in town is an artillery battery, and where a lot of my buddies that I was graduating with were going. But I was, you know, I wanted to be infantry or kind of nothing at all. So I was, you know, again, like I said, lucky that Nashville had a infantry company up there.
How far is Nashville from you?
About an hour 45.
You know, Nashville on the western side of Tennessee, you don't realize that, honestly, you don't realize that Alabama and even below it, Pensacola, Florida, is kind of
right.
Geographically where it is. You know, you meet people from, I know Pensacola, Florida is in the central time zone, and you're like, what? No, it's Florida. It's on the East Coast. And they're like,
that panhandle's long.
Yeah, and you're like, you're only 2 hours? Like, how does that work? No way. And then you look at it, and you're like, wow, because the distance between the end of the panhandle to New Orleans, right, is not that great. And you're like, wow.
No, not at all.
I didn't realize that. And so when you think of Alabama, you think, you know, it's just inside the eastern seaboard. Well, if it's under western Tennessee, it ain't. Okay, it ain't. So there's Georgia. You got to go through Georgia and North Carolina, so Alabama a little bit, So you join. So you graduate from high school in what? 2003, 2004.
All right,
and then what?
Then let's see, boot camp in Parris Island from, you know, June to August. Then training battalion. then ITB up in Camp Geiger, and then just started doing the drilling thing for about, I guess the end of 2004 until June 2006 when we got activated to deploy.
All right. So tell me, your parents, are they supportive?
Oh yeah. They're definitely supportive. Proud.
All right.
You know, all those things.
All right. Yeah. So they're
definitely into it.
So that's 2004. When do you do your first combat deployment?
First and only was 2006 from June. We were activated because we got in country the beginning of October, and I want to say we left probably the beginning of May, since we were deactivated in June.
Luke Gunner and I are battle buddies. Yeah, we're all Luke's in the city. Of Fallujah. Mike's outside on one side. I'm outside on the other side. I'm at Camp Fallujah. Mike's at a place called Habaniya on the other side of the Euphrates River. or actually Habonim is on this side of the Euphrates River. No, it's not. It's on the other side. I'm thinking of Rock, Michigan. So we're all there at the same time. Tell everybody what you do. At this, when you deploy by then, what rank are you? Lance Corporal? Corporal?
Lance Corporal, correct.
Right? So you're the backbone of the Marine Corps, right?
Right, oh yeah.
Right behind Major.
So
you're training with your company. What battalion is that in Nashville?
Well, Nashville's 3rd Battalion, 24th Marines, and there was a bunch of us in the battalion that were new joins, because I guess the battalion had just gotten back from a deployment in the very end of 2004, and we were all joining the unit. So there was spread amongst the battalion. There was a lot of us that hadn't deployed, so we were augmented to 124 out of Michigan, and there was a platoon of Nashville guys that had their platoon, the company, and there was about six of us that went to one of the other platoons, and then some of them, the weapons guys, got spread out in the weapons. But we're just the augments for, we're in 124, kind of thrown around from different companies.
Got it. So when you deploy, what's your job? What are you doing?
I was a rifleman, but I guess just the way we understood it was just provide security throughout Fallujah. We're our FOB is the train station, so RAO was about Route Fran, up north into the desert. I'm not really sure how far, and then over to the west into Sacagawea. And I remember being just a lot of boring stuff like census ops, and then just some presence patrols to the occasional fun stuff, doing a raid or a battalion op where you search a couple blocks and that sort of thing. But just kind of patrolling around, manning OPs, just doing the regular, firm base rotation of defense, main effort, and OPs.
Fallujah, unlike Ramadi, was pretty well locked up. The geography of Fallujah kind of lends itself to it's not that hard to isolate. And the train station was part of it. There was berms that had been built around the city. And Fallujah, again, unlike Ramadi, was a little bit easier to isolate and make it harder for them to get in the city. Were you there when a Marine walked off a firm base? Do you remember that?
That sounds familiar. There was an incident where some Marines fell asleep on a cordon and their truck didn't come back in from the op until about half an hour later. And I'm pretty sure everyone in that area was, they had a name for it. I don't remember what it was called, but it was probably something pretty similar to someone walking off at the base.
Yeah, this guy, obviously.
Is that different?
Yeah, it was different. This guy,
okay.
He got in an argument with squad leader. He was acting weird. Squad leader took his weapon away. And he said, well, if I don't have a weapon, then I'm not any good here. Fuck it. Takes all of his shit off, and he hops over the fence, and he takes off. And they don't notice him until maybe 15 or 20 minutes later. And then, your fear is that this guy's going to be on TV within 24 hours getting his head sawed off. And, and we're not having that. And everybody, we emptied every firm base around to go looking for him. Finally see him with a drone. And he's walking through this field, and you're like, we need to get him before, the shitheads do. And, the commandant came down into our COC. And so we're talking to the battalion. They're chasing him. We're watching the predator feed. You have General Neller, who's a brigadier general. You have the mess sergeant major in there. And they're screaming and yelling. And Neller had been my battalion commander. And I finally looked at him and said, hey, sir, this got to stop, right? They know what they're doing. They're watching the same feed. And he looks at me and he says, so what are you telling me, to shut the fuck up? I said, well, I didn't use those words, but if they need our help, they'll yell, right? And he says, come on, Sergeant Major, they don't need us anymore. And then they yoke the guy up, and we cut the feed off because I think they beat him up a little bit, but can't have that as evidence and everybody watching it. That's not good. So
You, how's that feel to Big Boy the Commandant in your COC?
Well, if you didn't Big Boy him, he would get pissed at you later. Like, why'd you let that shit show? Why'd you let that shit show go on for so long? Because I'm afraid. Yeah, he wouldn't. He would like that. And then he saw me, like, I don't know. He saw me a few days later, and he looked at me and he goes, "Think you run that thing, don't you?" And I said, "Come on, sir." I'm like, I need a brigadier general and a mess sergeant major in their screaming commands that I'm going to give a battalion who's watching the same shit with their CO. He goes, "Hey, shut up. I don't want to hear that."
That's awesome.
I know. It was actually pretty funny. So tell me about the deployment. Is it a good deployment for you guys? It is a tough deployment for you guys. Tell me about the effect it has on you.
I feel like it was definitely kind of tough. We were all novices. We were lucky in that the platoon commanders that we picked up on our workup, they all had a deployment under their belt.
Wow.
So we were fortunate in that aspect. But as far as, you know, us enlisted guys, I believe that I don't think we had anybody that had deployed. So we were all new to it. And I think, you know, you have a certain mindset, when you first start going out and everything. And then you have another mindset, you know, after you start taking casualties.
Explain that.
Well, you know, for the first, it was 23 days before, at least before our platoon. We had another Marine wounded about a week into an IED, but he was sent home, but he was expected to make a full recovery. wasn't missing any limbs or anything. So, you know, that was, you know, hitting an IED. You know, we'd already hit some without taking any wounded, so that didn't seem like anything, you know, too outside of the norm. But yeah, like, you know, getting ready for a mission. I guess you could say before it got kind of real, you know, it's more high fives, you know, getting pumped up and stuff like that. And you know, just kind of an excitement to it, but it's an excitement based on not knowing, where the reality can lead to. And, we hit our first, pressure plate on the 23rd, killing two Marines, severely wounding two others and wounding pretty good another.
23rd of what?
Of October. We got to the train station, I want to say October 1st.
Okay.
So yeah, they're at the end of that first month or that third week. We're pretty much out running around doing snap OPs, you know, vehicle snaps. And right. We had two teams that were sort of doing it in a satellite kind of way.
Let me just hop in here, just so everybody understands. One of the things where we used to catch a lot of bad guys was we would execute division-wide snap vehicle checkpoints. So, you know, so when Luke says snap VCP, that's what it is. And that is every unit in the AO at let's just say 1100 today is gonna stop what they're doing, and they're gonna set out a series of checkpoints where you're just going to start checking people. We used to catch so many dudes, bad guys, when we did that. It was amazing. It was one of the most effective things we did. Unbelievable.
I was going to say, even at the, you know, the platoon level, we saw the effects. I mean, it wasn't every stop, but it was, I mean, we seemed to find ourselves doing snap OPs pretty often if we were in vehicles. And I mean, it wasn't uncommon to get someone's GNC, you call it in, and, you know, they'd be a capture kill, and it's like, wow, you know, I mean, there's just bad guys just rolling around randomly in the city, and we happen to get one.
Yeah. Capture kill are guys on a list that you're authorized to capture or kill. You're not authorized to do that to anybody, but all of a sudden you run this guy's, you know, bat data, or you find an ID and you run it, and lo and behold, he's on a list that you can kill him, but you can't kill him when you have him.
Yeah. Right.
You're right.
But it gets everyone, yeah, a little excitement. I mean, it's, right. You know, of all the monotony that a lot of that produces, you know, it's always nice when you happen on somebody that you're out looking for. But on that day, we're out, yeah, in front of snap OPs and ran them, you know, in the morning, went to Camp Bahariya to get some lunch chow. and then headed back out to do some more for the evening. And it was down that near on Route Ethan south of Fran, where it, about the area where it starts to get kind of a little more of a dirt road.
Right.
And that's it was just outside of, you know, some Moose's house, you know, the pressure plate. And I was in the other team. We were broken into platoon was split in half. And I was up in the turret of the lead Vic with our lieutenant, and we just started seeing, you know, red star clusters going off, and you know, that's pretty obvious that, you know, where someone's hurting, and it's obviously got to be our guy because they're pretty close. And
so when you say you were when you say you were broken out, so you had four up armored Humvees rolling around.
Yeah, I'd say so four sounds right.
Okay,
yeah.
So you were moving in two groups of two. As you patrolled?
We're moving in two groups of four,
okay.
I would say.
All
right. Because the whole platoon was out.
Okay. All right. So you had eight vehicles in the whole platoon. And so you're
correct.
You're moving in four vehicle groups. Okay. All right. And so you start seeing the red star
clusters. So, yeah, we start seeing the clusters, and we were having trouble with the comps. So we were just kind of, you know, trying to follow those best we could. And I remember, yeah, we round the corner, and the Humvee was on its side, and it was crazy seeing where the blast crater was and where the location of the Humvee was. I mean, if you put a pressure plate right underneath the bottom of one, you know, it just sends them flying pretty good. And as you remember, you know, the armor on the bottom of the Humvees just, it's non-existent. It's just not designed that way. So, you know, anytime there's a blast underneath, it's pretty catastrophic. Which this one was. And, you know, we obviously secured the area, EOD came and everything, and we did our best to search the surrounding houses, looking for any type of, you know, seeing where the command deck went or anything like, well, when command deck is pressure plate.
But, right.
Looking for any, you know, any evidence, but, you know, of course we didn't find anything, but I think that really opened our eyes, obviously, to what war's like, you know, seeing your buddies die and all of that, and how quickly just the entire outlook can change. And, but I'd say that was obviously was a defining moment for our platoon. We, you know, it wasn't as much, you know, slapping high fives and stuff like that after that. We were getting ready to go out. It took on a more serious air. Same thing with, you know, anytime gearing up for QRF, and, even just going and making the chow runs through ECPs, it wasn't, we didn't really look at anything as a cakewalk anymore.
All right, so that happens relatively early in the deployment. How does the rest of the deployment go? Because you see a whole lot of life, right, that none of us had been introduced here to here in the United States, whether it's the way the Afghans lived, sometimes, you know, I mean, stonings and stuff that you know, are unheard of here. All of a sudden, you know, I remember one day looking at a crowd and, you know, hey, what's going on there? Like, well, we don't know. There's a crowd. Is it going to be a riot about fuel? What is it? You know, all right, stand by, you know, and ask, you know, tell the intel guy or the air officer, hey, you know, have the drone zoom in. And all of a sudden it zooms in and you're watching a young woman be stoned for whatever reason. And it's, I mean, it's things that you never can get out of your head. You know, here's a little girl, a young girl, and I was, you know, you see these grown men throwing rocks and hitting her, and it's almost like you have to turn away because it's disgusting. So talk about the rest of the deployment. Did it steady state like that? Did it get worse? Did it get better?
I mean, it kind of I'd say kind of steady state. It was just a bit of just like anything in, you know, over there or any type of, or anywhere where there's combat, you know, just the randomness on, you know, is an attack effective? Is an attack ineffective? Cause, you know, obviously we'd continue to hit IEDs. That was just kind of the normal thing around there. But, we had the biggest engagement we had, which also resulted in some more of our Marines, killed and wounded. Was there in the end of December. We were, you were out of there by the end of 2006, weren't you?
Yeah, I left in October. Okay.
Well, Well, we were turning the city over to the IPs and the IAs, and it was supposed to be, I believe, January 1st, where the only things we would be doing in the city is part of our rotation. We'd go to the government center there where Charlie Company was staying and where the, I guess, our Iraqi police headquarters was and all that sort of thing. And we'd go out with the IPs, but it would be, you know, they would lead the patrols and we would just be their kind of support. But, so we were going to the city. It was kind of a last mission sort of thing. Set up an OP, just for the day where, you know, went in the middle of the night, you know, pretty much, you know, handsomely paid a family to let us use their house for a day. And, so we were two families. We split up into two houses and, you know, knocked out some murder holes on the roof so we can, you know, just at least have some posts to stand. And, I think that morning we started taking accurate sniper fire that was going through those holes that we knocked out, impacting the inside of the I guess other part of the roof. So we knew they were, you know, shooting at us and I guess, we got a report that there was a sniper that was using basically a rolled up carpet to transport his rifles, in and out of his car and right. into the buildings he was occupying.
Right.
And lo and behold, just up the street, someone spotted someone getting out of a car with a rolled up carpet heading into a house. Which we didn't know at the time, but that was, I guess that was intel, you know, fed to us by the bad guys.
Right.
And, so they sent out, they sent out an element to go investigate that, the squad minus, which kind of just to kind of segue into, as far as some of the things I struggle the most with, when it comes to PTSD, I guess you'd say is, the survivor's guilt aspect of it.
Right.
And that kind of comes into play with this. The fire team that I was in, which was first team, first squad, and I was the rifleman. Our fire team got pulled off of out of the squad for whatever reason to be in a different house for that mission. And so it was the squad that, you know, was my squad leader and our guys out there going to investigate that. While the team I was in was asleep upstairs, you know, we were, you know, wasn't one of our posts.
Right.
So we're asleep and they're out there. They investigate. There's nothing to it because that was the whole idea, just to get Marines in the street. Unbeknownst to us, a bongo truck had pulled up beside the house we were in and had a sniper laying in the bed and he was waiting on the Marines to come back. And, he killed, one of our Lance Corporals, Lance Corporal Miller, who was walking point that day. And then, also our squad leader, Corporal Eskelson was killed. And then a friend, Billy Spencer immediately, you know, just as Marines did, you know, rushed out to Corporal Eskelson and, was in the process of dragging him to safety, when he was mortally wounded. And, he was awarded the Silver Star for that, which, you know, nothing brings your friends back, but that sure is I feel a big sense of pride knowing that, you know, that at least he was recognized that day for what he did. But, it just, well, one of the things I struggle with a lot is, I play it over in my mind that, you know, if I were out there on the street that day, walking point, would I have, you know, seen that sniper? Cause I fancied myself a decent point man. And I guess that's one of the things I really roll around and kind of question is if maybe, you know, if it would have been a little bit different if I could have had a chance to get my gun on the guy. But that was I guess the last, engagement we had, last casualties. Luckily, it was kind of nice. We pulled ECP duty last. Our platoon did on the rotation. So we headed off to the ECP a couple days after that for the next couple months. And then just, only had a few weeks of, you know, doing the left seat, right seat with the battalion that relieved us. And we were home after that. So it was kind of nice going to an ECP after, you know, after a day like that. But it's just, you know, it's just the frustration of, you know, in a fight like that where about the only chance you have to shoot at anybody, some muzzle flashes. You know, and of course they beat deep and then we start clearing houses. And, I think one of the things that sucked the most about being over there is besides the occasional, if you're lucky on an OP, you get the, you know, lights on up and, you know, planting an IED, there wasn't really much, I don't know if retribution is the right word, but, you know, it felt like they were getting to get theirs and we weren't really getting ours.
No, and I think that's one of the hard parts about insurgencies is that they decide 99% of the time. They decide on, you know, when and where the engagement's going to be, and you're essentially a counterpuncher.
Right. Yeah.
And I said this. I mean, if they could have hit what they were shooting at, I don't think
a lot worse off.
Yeah, our casualties would have been five times what they were, but they couldn't shoot for shit. In fact, if they were normally, and let me, and since the whole sniper thing you're talking about, when you saw somebody with first rounds impacting people, that means somebody else was there. That was not the local, you know, people getting after you. Somebody,
right.
Somebody else, whether they were checking in or they were some other guys that were experienced from someplace else. When you saw first round hits, that was like, all right, that got your attention.
When kind of looking back on it, I mean, I think we probably should have been a little bit more ready for it. It was pretty much at the, I believe it's the Hadra Mosque. We were right by there, yeah. Ethan and Kathy.
Right.
Definitely a pretty hot area. And I think, one of the other platoons had been on the same block, I think maybe a week before doing a snap OP, and they got into a pretty good fight there as well. But
you're doing that when you're doing that every day, right? And you're,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Right,
it's not like, so I know in retrospect, you say, well, this part, but you know, it's not like you weren't paying attention. You know,
you did it every day.
Yeah. And normally there's sometimes things that catch your eye. Why are all the shops closed today? Why is there nobody in this part of the town? And, you know, there's just, you know, you when you live and make your living there, there's certain things that catch your eye that you know something's going to happen. And then some days the local citizens don't know. It's just another day. And in retrospect, I think we beat ourselves up for not saying things. But if there was anything amiss, you would have seen it because your eye gets trained to that. And it is part of that. Talk to me about Luke. My guest is Luke. Fiance of Emma, daughter of Libby, infantryman, United States Marine Corps. And first of all, Luke, how old are you?
I'm just turned 32.
All right. So we were talking about yesterday on a story about a guy named Carlos Lopez who took his own life. He's 3 years older than Luke. He's 35. And probably had many of the same experiences. And I want to talk about, so you come home and you don't deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan again. Do you get out of the reserves? What happens when you come home?
When I came home, I had, you know, for the first time in my life, I thought, you know, maybe college is something that I'm interested in now.
Right.
And some of my friends had started up the club hockey team down at the University of Alabama. And, you know, they're like, hey, man, you know, come down here and play. And I was thinking that's crazy. You know, I haven't skated in 5 years, but here's an opportunity to, you know, play some, you know, club level college hockey. So I, you know, jumped at that opportunity. And in retrospect, I think I tried to do a little too much too quick. I was still in the Marines. I was transferred down to Alabama, started playing hockey. I transferred units down to a company in Bessemer, which is just an hour up the road as opposed to Nashville is about four at that point.
Right.
And looking back, I mean, it just seemed kind of a simple move, but I kind of, you know, when I left the unit, you know, I kind of lost touch with a lot of the guys I deployed with. And I know that was kind of the start of, starting to, you know, kind of, I guess, lose that connection of some of the friends that, you know, I fought with. but so I transferred to this other unit, and I was out of the Marine Corps a couple of years after that. And I think it was when I got out in 2010, and I'd stopped playing hockey by then as well. That just, you know, I started, you know, realizing that just, I mean, I wouldn't want to say maybe there's something wrong with me, but I started noticing.
You could say that.
That something wrong with me. I was having a hard time, I guess, processing things that usually I wouldn't have a hard time with.
Like, for instance?
I guess hypervigilance. Not being able to sleep, you know, just hearing a slight sound and it just, you know, wakes me up and I'm going to be up for the rest of the night. Anything that...
Do you sleep through the night now?
I'm much better at it.
That's not what I asked
sometimes
you.
Sometimes...
Do you sleep
through the night? Yeah, I actually sleep pretty well now. Because the hypervigilance and then definitely... Because I'd had some nightmares and whatnot when I came home. But it wasn't anything too serious. But I guess the nightmares kind of turned into a whole other thing that I can just only describe it as some of the realest experiences I've had, you know, outside of consciousness. And I think that's when I start drinking a lot more too, because I found that, you know, if I drank myself to sleep, I wouldn't have these nightmares. And that seemed to work okay for a little while until it just started exacerbating all these other problems.
All right. So that starts in 2010. When do you meet Emma?
Met Emma, let's see, God, it's been almost 5 years. Let me do some math.
So around that time, you meet Emma.
Let's see, 2013, a few years after, because okay. I was probably at my worst when I met her.
Nice. And so she was somehow or other attracted to that hot mess you were.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Which means
pretty normal mutual friends.
Which means Emma's not right in the head either.
Probably not.
Nice.
She's got to love hearing that.
Exactly. No, we talk about like, look, we're our own screwed up human beings. So what does it say about the woman that's attracted to us? She's got issues. No, it's a universal. Like, okay. We could see why he's attracted to you, but what in God's name are you doing with him? And the only answer is, she's got issues. So talk to me about, when do you look at yourself and say, hey man, I got a problem, I need help?
I don't think it really happened overnight, but I definitely remember one day thinking, you know, I need to go to the VA. I think it was probably after, you know, many times of, you know, my mom suggesting, you know, hey, you know, it's, you know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with going and talking to somebody. You know, that's what they're there for, and you know, you should seek that out.
Is your mom the first person that said, hey, can we talk about you? Tell me about that.
I don't think they came to me. I think it was more of, I think it probably started, you know, they started realizing there was a problem when I would, you know, at least that's how I remember it. You know, I'd come home for the weekend from school down in Alabama, and I've got some, you know, Marine buddies here in town, and, you know, I'd go out for the night, you know, maybe come home, you know, 1:30, 2 in the morning, you know, drunk, and, you know, in my room, and just getting upset, and I guess, you know, thinking my friends, and, you know, punching a hole in the wall or something like that, and you know, there's no real, you know, hey, we need to talk when I'm behaving like that. It's I kind of brought the conversation, you know, on myself, I guess you could say, just based on my actions and how I was getting behaved.
What did she say?
Well, I think the one thing that my mom and dad as well, I think that I'm really blessed with, and one of the reasons I'm sure that I am doing as well as I am is that, I mean, it's nothing but love from them, and, you know, recognizing that they don't necessarily understand it or can't,
right.
but you know, it was just just concern and, you know, just out of love and wanting me to feel better.
What did she say, though, to you?
You know, I can't remember anything exact, but okay. I mean, but because her and we've talked quite a bit.
Did you, so let me ask you this, did you listen to the interview from yesterday? The Lopez family?
Yes, I did. God, it's heartbreaking, yeah.
When you heard her say, I wanted him to talk to me, and he said, if I tell you, you won't look at me the same, you won't love me the same. What were your thoughts when you heard that?
I mean, that's that was extremely rough to hear, and I feel like I've had similar conversations with my mom, feeling like that I'm some kind of animal, or that yeah, how, I mean, I didn't understand how I could be loved, you know, and I did felt shame, felt guilt, which, you know, to the rational mind didn't really make any sense, but you know, it was real in my mind, or it is real. And, but I just remember her just being trying to be there for me and love me and just support me. And at the same time, gentle nudges as far as, you know, hey, you know, we're concerned about, you know, how much you're drinking, and, you know, that's, you know, that only leads, you know, to, you know, just, you know, good advice to that sort of thing. But also that, you know, I need to go see someone at the VA because, and, you know, until kind of the VA sort of shine light on itself, you know, everyone kind of assumes that, you know, the VA is what we think it is, and that they're unprecedented in things like mental health and amputations and, you know, anything war related. You know, you just assume the VA is the authority on all that. So I remember deciding, I'm sure I probably woke up hungover with a fresh hole in my apartment. And I decided, you know, I got to go talk to somebody. This, you know, not being able to control my anger, just the emotional roller coaster, and that tied in with anxiety that I've never experienced in my life, along with this sense of hypervigilance that I just can't. You know, it's not that I'm bouncing off the walls, but I just can't tone it down. I can't, you know, quit my scan type thing. And but I remember going to the VA. And the VA in Tuscaloosa is interesting because I've had good things to say about it, and bad things. Right. I think with it being in a smaller city and actually being a full VA hospital, I think they probably had a little bit lower of a load than the VAs in the bigger cities.
Right.
So I think the quality of care with that was a little bit better.
You know what? Let me tell you. I've talked to guys who've gone to VAs in smaller communities, and they're spread throughout the United States. And I would tell you, by and large, that your observation, I think, is correct, that some of them rave about the care that they've received at those places. And so it's interesting. And from the physicians there to the counselors to even the administrative people, it comes out of small town America. And, you know, Gunnar and I talk about the quality of life in small town America. And it's no bullshit. Across the board, it's better. And I would tell you, just my informal poll of people, you know, when you go to big VA in big city, you don't get the same kind of service as you do when you go to a VA that's kind of a regional hub located in a smaller city. Just different. So I think you're spot on about that. And you know what? And everybody's VA experience is different. And it's different because who you deal with, that person becomes the VA for you. Yeah, Larry, he's the VA to me, and that's who I deal with. So you go down there, and you're how old? So at this time you're probably 27, 28.
Maybe 24. I think it was probably in. It wasn't that long after I started realizing. So I first got home. I mean, I was, you know, I guess everyone, like we all were doing. We were all, you know, going out and having a good time, drinking more than we should. But it wasn't, you know, sure I'd, you know, amongst Marines, you know, out at the bar, we'd pour drinks out and kind of mourn a little bit our friends and everything. But it wasn't PTSD. It was just kind of kind of living a little bit recklessly. Once it developed into, it was almost like overnight, it started with a, I'm anxious in this crowd all of a sudden, or just like walking to class, or I would feel anxious. And anxiety was a new sensation. I'm not an anxious person. If anything, I'm like to be the center of attention a little too much sometimes. And so that was really strange that I would even feel anxious. And then I think with that anxiety kind of brought I started noticing that I was, which I Googled how I felt, and hypervigilant came up.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, that makes sense. I hear something, I'm snapping towards it. I hear a noise in my apartment. If I'm asleep, my first reaction is to reach over and grab my pistol and sit up. Then, pie the door into my living room, make sure nothing's in there. Check the locks. And I think that's when I started realizing, man, there's, this isn't normal. So I go to the VA, and, the first psychiatrist I talked to, I don't even remember, because I stayed for the session, but afterwards when I scheduled another, I asked if I could see somebody else. I was kind of expecting them to be like, no, you get who you get, but they were actually like, yeah, that's no problem. We'll we'll try you with this other person. So that was great, and I came back, and this lady, she was very nice, and she was very caring. I just don't think that maybe she was equipped to, I don't really think she maybe understood. And I think a lot of us, I think at that time, a lot of us were still learning about it, but I don't think she really maybe understood PTSD. But what she did allow is she gave me a forum to just talk. And she would just listen. She'd nod. She'd maybe throw out, a couple little points of encouragement. And that would be it. And I would leave feeling good. But also the first thing was, she was going to, hey, let's try some drugs. The success rate is amazing. And I think, to no fault of her own, I think she was kind of giving me a false sense of hope that this was something that's, it's just like having a stomach bug. You take some pills and then you can be cured. These change the way you feel and make you feel normal. And I think that was really exciting to me, because it was, I'd seen her a couple times, and I was noticing that my symptoms were just, if anything, were getting worse. And so I would drink to try and combat that, which, kind of seems to feel like it works for a minute, but
right.
I think we all know it doesn't.
Right.
And so that added to things. Like, I started, I'm sure, to feeling for depression and stuff like that. You can't help if you're drinking all night and feeling like crap all day. But she, I had the idea that I could start taking some pills and that it would be some sort of, magic. And she warned me though, we might have to try a few different combinations because everybody's different. Okay, that sat fine with me. That makes sense. And so I kind of started doing the change the medication dance for about, I want to say, I tried this for maybe a year and a half, probably three different combinations of drugs. And what I found was, for each new iteration, I would feel good for a few days. I'm sure probably a placebo effect. I was wanting it to work.
Right.
But then I would start to feel this weird kind of numbness, not a physical numbness, but like an emotional, And I was coming from, without taking the pills, I was an emotional roller coaster where I would feel every emotion kind of to the extreme. And then these pills for the other extreme of that, to where I couldn't even, like, I didn't feel empathetic about things, like, just normal things that you would, feel sympathetic or empathetic towards. I felt nothing.
The word that I hear used most often for this state is zombie.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. You just kind of sleepwalking through life, and I couldn't, not that I was doing very well in school anyway, but I found I was doing worse, and I just kind of decided that, well, if I have to choose between not feeling any emotion at all or trying to live with this emotional roller coaster, I think that was the, I guess, kind of first step into trying to figure it out on my own. I quit taking the pills, and I just quit going back to the VA at that point, and I've been back since.
All right, so you stopped going to the VA when?
Well, I will say this too. I remember they, because, you know, I was asking, is there anything else, you know, what else do you have besides talk to a counselor or a psychiatrist? And they put me in this group thing that I tried going to a couple times. That was, it was a bunch of veterans, you know, us veterans sitting around, and it was a, you know, we had a workbook, and we had this person, you know, going through these scenarios, like if someone cuts you off in traffic, and you know, we had to read these out loud and go through the different choices. And I look at some of these old Vietnam guys, and they you know, they've probably got a wife making them go to this or something, but they're all looking at each other with these looks of disgust on their face. And it just felt like we were getting treated like crayon eaters. I mean, that we kind of are, but still it's just ridiculous that there's absolutely no, I didn't see any benefit to that. And so I definitely didn't try that again.
That's the treatment protocol, Luke. Right. The treatment protocol is you'll be seen by a therapist. You'll get given these drugs, this one for anxiety, this one for sleep, this one for anger, and you'll go to group therapy. That's a treatment protocol.
Yeah. Well, that treatment sucks.
That is the universal response that I've heard. I have not heard anybody said, you know what, that really worked for me. I thought it was awesome. Maybe I just haven't met that person yet, but what I hear is people, you know, maybe that corresponds to what their insurance covers and how they don't get sued and things like that. But it's not helping me solve my issues. All right, so now you say you're going to do it on your own. What year are we now?
I would say probably maybe 2013.
Okay, 2013. How does sorting it out on your own again work?
Quit taking the pills. I didn't put the booze down. But and the funny thing with that was, you know, I thought I was doing a good job of kind of keeping it together. But then I'd maybe have an exam the next day, and I'd sleep in and miss the exam, wake up, punch a fresh hole in my wall, and then proceed to rush down to my teacher's office with my hat in my hand, you know, begging that, you know, I overslept and, you know, I'm an idiot. Is there any way I can, you know, make this up? And I did that dance for a while and so, you know, I'm dropping classes. I'm passing some stuff. I'm dropping others, and I'm getting suggestions from my parents that, you know, maybe you need to pack it up and, you know, come on home and, you know, regroup from here. And maybe that might have been the prudent thing to do, but I guess just being who I was, you know, we don't quit at anything we start, right? And I sure as hell wasn't, you know, I never cared about college until after I got home from Iraq, so I sure as hell wasn't gonna let the first thing I do, you know, post Marine Corps be something I quit at. So I decided to stick it out, you know, even, you know, but the habits were still bad. I wasn't really improving in that sense. But I started running around with a better group of friends, and so that started to, that was kind of the first change, is, you know, kind of changing my friends up, and with that is where I met Emma through some mutual friends, and I was, you know, I was pretty impressed by her. She's, you know, really smart, and I need some homework help, she seemed kind of interested in me, and I thought, you know, wow, this might be something worth pursuing. And if I'm, you know, going to pursue this, I'm going to need to start, you know, changing some aspects about my life.
All right. So now you have M in your life. You're still self-medicating with booze. You're not seeing anybody.
Still working at, I'm working at bars.
Right.
So, you know,
there you go. You got the whole shit show going. So, all right. So you go sideways in this cycle, right? Of now you have a girl, and episodes come and go. What's the next thing that impacts your life?
I guess the next thing that impacts my life is, finally, you know, I graduate and I come home, and I'm kind of figuring out what I want to do here. Emma and I had just gotten a house together. It's been about a year ago. And I started listening to All Marine Radio, I'd say, probably 2 years ago.
How did you come across it?
Man, when I came back to Huntsville, I wouldn't really call it a relapse, but I wasn't really getting my shit in gear.
Okay, if it's not a relapse, what would you call it?
Well, I would just say just continuing the behaviors.
Okay.
Anything, just I didn't pump the brakes as much as I thought I did, and just, you know, just still going out, drinking too much, not definitely not being responsible with it. I just joined a rifle range out here, and I was out shooting, which I hadn't done in ages, and I was just sitting out there, you know, putting my guns up and everything, and I just recently gotten into podcasts, and there was this other Marine one I found. It popped up a little quicker than All Marine Radio, called Cigars and Sea Stories, which is a little bit more of a, you know, it's a younger, you know, couple corporals, you know, just, you know, it's turned into kind of an entrepreneurial show, but that's the first podcast I kind of got into.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started searching around, like, there's got to be, you know, more Marine Corps stuff out here. And because I just, there for a while, I felt like if I just kind of, you know, because I was under the impression that, you know, this is something that I can cure, you know, that this is, I'm not going to feel this way forever. You know, there's light at the end of this tunnel, which there is, just not in the sense that I understood it. And I kind of thought that maybe if I distanced myself from, you know, just, you know, being a Marine, you know, keep the values, but maybe try and not have that stuff on my mind as much, maybe not talk to some of the same old people anymore. And I thought that was maybe a, you know, good way to go, but it only made things worse. So I was kind of in the process of like, man, I need to, you know, I'm proud. Why am I feeling, you know, why am I walking around with guilt and shame when I should be, you know, I've always been proud to be a Marine. So why am I letting these feelings run my life? So I started trying to just find Marine stuff. And, I happened upon All Marine Radio and, caught an episode. I think it was a real early discussion on women in combat. This was a couple of years ago, but I found that really interesting, and it was pretty obvious that you were a grunt. And, it's like, man, this is neat. So I was kind of listening off and on, but I think when I really started listening was, I caught the Jeremiah Workman interview, not too long after, or when I was searching back through your episodes, I started seeing all this stuff, like, holy cow, man, like this, there's a whole wealth of information in here. And then I remember I was just cleaning the kitchen up, doing the dishes, and I'd like, you know, listen to All Marine Radio when I'm, you know, cleaning up around here. And you and the gunner were talking, and this is after I emailed you guys about, you know, like, hey, y'all got any good advice on how to teach him how to shoot, you know, and that sort of thing. So I got to where I was a regular listener at that point.
Right.
And you said something about that, I earned my PTSD, and, you know, it's something that, you know, I think the gunner kicked in something like, I carry this burden with pride, you know, it's my burden to carry. And I kind of relate this like learning math, you know, you have these little aha moments,
right.
And the more the aha moments you kind of put together, the more you get to understand the big picture. And that was probably the biggest one of those moments I'd ever had with since post combat. I'd never heard anyone say anything like that. And I mean, you know, I'd be lying if I said, I mean, I broke down right there. It's like, holy cow. I mean,
what?
That was the craziest thing I'd ever heard.
No, it really we're not going to go there. Good God.
No,
man.
Hey, we all know that we don't always talk about Marine stuff on here.
I know.
That was a moment of truth. I mean, and I think through my just bouncing through this, you know, post combat life, you know, with the drinking and all that crap, I think I was doing all that because I was trying to find these, you know, answers to my questions that couldn't be answered. But that was just an insight that I hadn't heard before, that I hadn't heard it from that perspective. And it kind of, it kind of kick-started me a little bit that, you know, and these little truths like, you're broken or you're damaged, but you're not broken, and that this is a tribal thing, and that there are, you know, I mean, there's a shitload of us living with trauma, and it's not just here, you know, with combat veterans. And I think that, I guess just, the inclusive nature of the tribe like that, I think I've been missing that. And especially the, you know, just hearing some of those truths that this is something that's going to remain with you, but it's something that you can learn to live with, and there's good practices and there's bad practices. And I've learned that I'm pretty much king of the bad practices. So I can, you know, only go up from here.
But you have a lot of company. I mean, the thing about you, Luke, is that, I mean, you're no different than a whole lot of other Marines out there who got irritated with the bag of drugs, the group therapy, and talking to somebody who you don't identify with. They're well intentioned, right? You're trying to do what they say, but I mean, imagine my experience with a guy who was a grunt in Vietnam, right? Like completely different from your experience, right? With a woman who's never been part of the Marine Corps and never fought at all, and so so I think your path is a well traveled path. So I'm curious. I want to talk about the drinking piece, because it's in my conversation with you that planted in my head, why don't we just tell people not to drink? Because around the 4th of July or before the 4th of July, I either texted Luke or emailed him or something, and I said, yo, you have to stop drinking. And he said, I know. I said, no, not like that. You have to stop drinking, man, because you can't deal with PTSD while you're drinking like this. And I get these emails in the middle of the night. What were you doing up in the middle of the night like that?
Well, it's just that, I mean, it's when I'm the only person up awake, it's when I, you know, drink like that, and just, I get off kind of late at work and stay up, I guess, but just, you know, unhealthy habit.
So he's, you know, you've heard of drunk dialing. He's drunk emailing me. And these things would come, bam, 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 bam. And I don't sleep for shit, right? So I roll over, I wake up, I look at my phone. Why I got 5 emails in the middle of the night? I look, they're from Luke. And they would always go like, he'd vent, he'd then give the counter argument, and then he would apologize for emailing me. And so I don't know. I mean, this went on for a few months, right? And it wouldn't happen all the time, but it happened on a fairly regular basis. And so I finally said, no, man, this is an order. You have to stop drinking. And it was before the 4th of July. And then I called him on the 4th of July and I said, hey, man, what are you doing? He said, oh, nothing. I said, are you drinking? He said, no. I said, don't lie to me because I'll find out. He said, no, I'm not. He said, if I have one, it'll just be to be social. I'm not drinking, though. All right. Talk about liquor and PTSD.
It's a bad combination. I mean, it's the only way that the gorillas get unleashed, that's for sure. I mean, I know that, you know, it's one thing to have a beer, too, and leave it at that. It's another thing to drink, you know, start drinking liquor. I mean, it's just, it's almost like the snap of the fingers that it takes you to a different place. And, I mean, it's depressing just thinking about it. You know, you act out. I mean, you get all sorts of upset, you know, you're crying, acting like a fool. And then and the next day you wake up with, you know, regret and with guilt for how you acted, and, you know, checking your phone, see how many emails you sent Mac, or if you're, and talking shit to your friends at night. And
what did I do?
It's a bad cycle to get into. And
but do you think it's, you know, in my opinion, it's the cycle, though? Yes.
Yeah, it is.
It's the cycle that most Marines get into, in that I can go to sleep, I pass out, I slept through the night. But it is the cycle. And so in dealing with Luke, I don't know what made me think of it. All of a sudden, this is like my own blinding flash to the obvious. Why don't we tell people you got to stop drinking if you're dealing with PTSD? And I thought, oh, man, that sounds so un-Marine-like. Shit, everybody, I can hear the clicks. Click, 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 click. Did he just say stop drinking? Holy shit, man. Well, McNamara lost his mind. This is the Marine Corps, man. We lead the league in unprotected sex and binge drinking. It's why we're Marines. It's what we do. What did he just say? But it's the truth. It's the absolute 100% truth that if you think you can deal with post-traumatic stress and drink at the same time, you're lying to yourself. You're lying to yourself. So let me ask you this. How has your life changed since you stopped drinking the way you used to drink?
Well, I don't feel crappy in the mornings, and I'm certainly much more productive. And on top of that, you know, cause you still have my days where I need my Mai Tai, but it's, I think it's, I've also, you know, when I do wake up feeling that way, you know, I tell myself, hey, well, remember, you're not gonna pick up booze on the way home from work because you're feeling this way. You're just gonna recognize it. And I find that, that even just telling myself that, you know, I'm not gonna get drunk over this, maybe the newness of that'll wear off, but it's almost like there's some relief just in knowing that I'm not gonna, you know, go down that road that I usually would. I'm not gonna put myself through that, or not put necessarily myself, but, you know, especially when my actions overflow to, you know, loved ones. I'm not gonna give anyone a reason to worry tonight. And there's just a lot of comfort in that, where it would be if I were feeling down or, you know, missing my friends a little bit more than usual. The natural thing was, well, I'm going to hit the bar or something like that tonight. And, you know, change how I feel. But that, again, like we've been talking about though, that road, I mean, it's the same path. It never ends up any differently. The only way it could end up different, you know, end up dead or in jail, which I thank God that, you know, I never hurt myself or anybody throughout this whole process, at least, you know, any more than I did, you know, as far as, but I'm glad never harmed or anyone or myself. But, yeah, it's just, it's definitely a relief because, I don't feel like that's something that I feel, I guess, compulsed to do.
Do you miss drinking?
No. And like I said, I mean, my birthday was last weekend. I had two beers when we were out, when me and Emma went out to eat. And that felt good to just have a couple and walk away and feel satisfied with that, you know, it was a out birthday dinner, had a couple beers, you know, nothing to it. Instead of going home and now I'm going to, you know, open up a bottle of whiskey and, you know, really whip it on. You know, so I definitely feel good not doing that anymore.
So, have you had any thoughts about going back to the VA, Luke, or do you not? Do you feel like that you're in a better place that you don't need to go back to that? Do you feel like they helped you, or did they just do their thing and it wasn't for you and you left?
The only experience I have up here now that I'm in Huntsville with the Huntsville VA is right. It's a whole other story on suckiness of care, but it has nothing to do with mental health. But I haven't been up here to mental health yet. I don't see how it would do any harm to at least maybe go up there and just have a visit and get the lay of the land for this VA.
Hey, can I give you some advice? If you do go back there, ask if they have any combat veteran therapists on the staff. And that's who you would like to talk to. Because, again, you walk into the office and you see the shit that you know. Like, oh,
yep.
Here's his I Love Me shit. I've seen this. Right? And
right.
And there's an immediate familiarity with those guys. And, again, it was just by luck that I crossed paths with two guys. And my experience has been completely different. That's why I say, the VA, in my opinion, it ought to be a two-tiered system. It ought to be they pay for this program called, I would make it up, called Vetacare. It's exactly like Medicare. Where you go for your hemorrhoids, where you go for your hangnails, where you go for your, you know, your gallstone, anybody can do that. And here's your card, go get it taken care of. The VA would be world-class in post-combat related mental health, burns, amputees, traumatic brain injuries, and any other injury that would be like fundamental to training and combat. They would be specialists in that stuff. And that you would go there and you would get inducted into the system, and that you would go talk to combat veterans, right? And they'd be getting paid a lot of money to talk to guys like you and me. But you're going to feel at home. And so to me, that's what if you're going to go back there, go find that. Because it's there, it's around, and I believe it helps. I believe it helps. So I could be wrong. I'm not very often, but I could be.
Well, hopefully it'd be nice to see something like that implemented. I kind of figured we would already with Trump, but that's another subject.
No, it's a big. Let me tell you, for most of the country, the VA is a jobs program, right?
Yeah.
Look, just walk around the VA. I don't know that I've ever seen a larger group of obese employees in my life. How do you find and hire this many obese people in one organization? And I'm not hating on obese people. Well, maybe a little bit. What I'm just saying is that it's a jobs program. These people are not there. They're there for the job. They're not there to help veterans, and that's their passion. And the VA needs to somehow change the culture and to make it better. But it's a jobs program, and moving that is not going to be easy. Because every congressman has a vested interest in their VA not getting smaller, and they're not going away. And the federal employees union, they'll fight you every step of the way, too. So I don't know that it's an easy thing to fix. So that's
well, they can start with, here's one example of just, I think it's got to be bureaucracy at some form of it, or just stupidity. The VA up here in Huntsville, and I haven't seen this at the VA in Tuscaloosa, but up at the parking, up in the front where the handicapped parking spots are.
Right.
About half of them are handicapped, and half of them actually have a placard that reads, I have a picture of it on my phone. It reads, not environmentally friendly, I think hybrid vehicle parking.
Oh, yeah, actually, I've seen it.
Have you seen that?
Yeah.
I want to know who's paying where's that money coming from? But to even put stupid signs up for hybrid vehicle parking. It just seems like something like that is just like in a meme. One of the problems with what the VA is.
Yeah, it's like
their priorities are worried about that.
Take those parking spots, put blue placards on all of them, and then move those guys someplace else. Move them to the back of the parking lot. They're that interested in the environment. It'll get them some exercise, okay? And they'll get their free battery charge. How about that? That's all.
I don't know why that got my blood going.
No, because it's stupid. It's like we could have more blue placards for. And again, when you go to the VA, pretty humbling experience, right? You see a lot of older guys who are going to the VA because they don't have any health insurance, and this is how they're getting their health care.
Right.
Yeah, that's why they're at the VA, and it's pretty humbling to see those old guys in their wheelchairs, in their walkers. And their quality of life, and then somebody's gonna get a front row seat because they've got a hybrid car. Give me a fucking break.
Yep. Exactly.
So let me ask you this: as a young veteran, right? Mike and I talk about we're used to fighting bureaucracies over the course of a longer career, being older or whatnot. As a young veteran. Do you think a lot of younger veterans leave the VA because they just get tired of it? They're not good at fighting that bureaucracy. They don't have that much experience at it. You just think they say, this is bullshit. I'm out. Give me your thoughts.
Yeah, that's kind of not so much on – as far as the mental health, I kind of – my experience was I felt like they were kind of doing – what they could with the cards that they had. I mean, like I said, I thought they, you know, it was a, the, at least my experience with the individuals working there in mental health, they all seemed like they genuinely cared and they wanted to help.
Right.
It's just I think the help might have been a little bit misguided and maybe lacking in a little bit of research and maybe some of the most, you know, current trends of care. And I can't necessarily fault any individual for that, but I've got a real issue with just all of their other medical care, trying to get any type of procedure done or any type of test ran. Cause I do have, full VA, health care, but, I'm trying to get work done on my knees, and it's been a process that I've dealt with for over 5 years with them. And I'm to the point now where I'm just, you know, I'm waiting until I get out of school and get a real job with some real medical insurance and just putting up with it until then. The choice program is non-existent. I've tried to deal with that. I would say, and this ought to put it in perspective, I think, their mental health at the VA is they're at the absolute golden boys compared to everything else that happens at the VA. As far as trying to get care.
Got it.
For any type of injury or,
So when you hear the Gunner and I saying, hey, look, if you're struggling with that, go to the VFW, go to the Legion, go to your Marine Corps League detachment and go talk to those guys. Does that make sense? And find out who you can deal with to get to the front of the line, to get to somebody who will make something happen. Does that make sense or not?
It certainly does.
All Marine Radio, smart guy stuff.
But yeah, and definitely I'm getting hooked up with the league in the next town over. They've got a little bit younger of a detachment, and that's going to be one of my first questions is how to navigate, you know, the VA when it comes to non-mental health issues.
My guest is Luke, the infamous Luke. He is Libby's son, Emma's fiance, and an infantryman, United States Marine Corps veteran of combat in Fallujah. What 1st Battalion, 24th Marines you were with there with?
Correct. Bravo right. Company.
Bravo Company. What was Bravo's company's, Bravo what? What is it? What were they? Bravo.
Just Bravo.
Just Bravo? No Death Before Dishonor, Bravo?
Nah, our battalion was Wolverines.
Whoa.
Out of Michigan.
Wolverines. That's cool. All right. I gotta take I wanna take a break, and when we come back, I've got about three emails for you, and then we'll wrap this up because I know you gotta go to work. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we're gonna take a quick break. More from Luke. Got some email for him. Coming up next, we're talking about post-combat related mental health, and Luke's been gracious enough to talk to us about the journey of a younger veteran. You hear from us old guys all the time, so we're talking to him about the young guy stuff. So don't touch that dial, more of All Marine Radio. Coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good, but are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit veteranscrisisline.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
If I were the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place.
I want to be a billionaire so fucking bad. Buy all of the things I never had. I want to be on the cover of Forbes magazine, smiling next to Oprah and the Queen. Oh, every time I close my eyes,
Oprah, what's up?
I see my name in shiny lights. Yeah, a different city every night. Oh, I swear the world better prepare for when I'm a billionaire.
All right, 9:32 on a Wednesday. Joining us is the infamous Luke. And Luke, first of all, what time zone are you in? Are you guys in the Eastern time zone or Central?
Central.
That's amazing. Yeah, everybody thinks yeah. Alabama. They're like, yeah, they're not in the Central time zone. I got a funny email about that. I'll read it to you, Matt. So I'm listening, and you go off about Alabama and the panhandle of Florida being in the central time zone. I hear that, and I'm thinking, there's no friggin' way. So I look it up, and bigger than shit. Who knew? You know what? I had the same reaction. A friend of mine said, he's a pilot living in Pensacola. I said, well, I didn't want to call before, you know, this hour or whatever. He goes, dude, I'm only 2 hours ahead of you. And I said, I thought you said you were in Florida. Are you someplace else? He said, I am in Florida. I said, there's no part of Florida that's in central time zone. He said, oh, there is. I said, what? And had the same kind of epiphany, like, holy shit, man. Yeah, go on a map and then pull up your Google Earth and then just check it out. It's pretty crazy.
I need to make a MCI geography for Marines.
Well, I know, but you see Florida, right? And it's like if California had something that hooked a left at the base or at the top and stuck into New Mexico. That's what the panhandle is. You don't realize it. And you're like, yeah, the panhandle's like 2 hours from New Orleans or some shit like that. You're like, what? Yeah, that's wrong. That ain't right. Oh, I think it might be right. And if it's that, then New Orleans is right. That's the bottom of the Mississippi. That would be the center part of the country. What? What are you talking about? All right. Luke has graciously been a guest. Luke, let me just tell you, when I conceived of All Marine Radio, I had you in mind. And it would be a forum that we would talk about our culture, things that we find interesting. And then also sewn into that would be, you know, discussions about post-combat related mental health. And hopefully, because every single Marine I've ever talked to, when I've had a conversation with them that goes like, you think you're fucked up, don't you? And they look at you, and they're not sure, and they give you kind of the shoulder shrug and the big eyes like, I don't know. And then when I would say, well, you are fucked up, they would laugh and like, yeah, I know. And then you say, but you're fucked up like everybody else. You're a warrior, all right? You don't do that without it sticking to you. So you're going to be okay. And they look at you, and it's almost like this, this sigh. And then you begin to talk to him. You can't sleep. You have nightmares. Yeah, that's me. Okay, well, the best you're ever going to be is you're going to learn to coexist with this. And that makes sense to him, right? It's like somebody's finally telling me the fucking truth.
Yeah, I mean, it does make sense, and I think it's encouraging, because I don't want to be told that there's, you know, some sort of cure and to hope for something like that, because there's not. But I'd rather be told the way it is and be told the truth. This way I can, you know, get my shit in gear and start living.
Well, I mean, and I had that experience when Gunnery Sergeant Lance Y walks up and says, you know, you're never getting over this. Like, what the fuck did you just say? Like, that's not, like, I don't think you're supposed to say that to me right now. Right? And he's a big fucking galoot, man. He looks, and I'm sitting on these ammo crates and looking up at him, and he's looking down at me, and we had served together before, and he said, you need to know that. Why do I need to know that? Why would you say that to me? Why? Marines from Vietnam told me that. And then he had my fucking attention. And it took me all of a week to realize what good advice that was. That you're not getting over it. And I think when somebody does tell you that kind of stuff, you're like, yes, finally, somebody's telling me the truth, man. And so, that's, this whole thing is hopefully spawning discussions, and these emails are asking questions about that. For the people that whether they be Korean War, World War II, Vietnam veterans that have lived with this stuff forever, but they lived in silence with it, and we're kind of not that way. But that's what this was designed to do. And so hearing from you and then meeting you and Emma have been awesome for both, for me, and for, I know for Mike. So it's cool.
Huge,
and then,
huge for us. Too,
well,
back,
no,
of
and then, but the trick is now for you to become an evangelist yourself, right? So that when you meet other guys, that you regurgitate the same stuff that we've regurgitated and stolen from other people. And you're just preaching the gospel of post-combat related mental health, post-traumatic growth, and not only, and I'll tell you what, one of the things I said early in the program that felt really good was we were talking, I said, you know, we don't corner the market on this. There's a lot of other people that live with trauma, and we're part of that, and we can help other people in our communities with trauma. And I want All Marine Radio to be an exporter of best practices and speak to people with trauma. And so we're sitting there talking, and Emma then says, I had my own traumatic event. And I thought it felt so good that, like, us not being narrow, pinhead military guys. Oh, PTSD from combat. Oh, it's the worst thing ever. Oh, really? Because I can tell you a story about my older sister, and there's nobody I know that's lived through what my sister's lived through. So if we're going to play whose male appendage is bigger, guess what? My sister's bigger than everybody. So it puts it in perspective a little bit. But it also gives you a calling. I can help anybody who's been impacted by trauma. And I mean, and I think that feels good and it feels right. And so everything that you've gone through, you can now leverage to be somebody who helps other people. And I think that's part of the coexisting piece of it. It helps me coexist with this stuff because I know I can use it to make other people's lives better. And I think it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. But it is that warrior spirit. I'm not going to be defeated by this. I'm going to find what I can. I'm going to help other people. The lives that of my battle buddies that were lost will not be in vain because I'm going to use what's come out of that to help other people for the good. And I think that's as good as it gets. But anyway, let me ask this. Here's some email. Mac, listening to your guest this morning, first of all, I want to thank him for coming on and sharing with everybody. I know it's not the easiest thing to do, so first of all, thank you. Question, as a parent, how would I approach my son or daughter if they were in a similar situation? How would he tell me to do it so that my discussion with him would be fruitful and positive and not didactic, I think he wrote, didactic and demanding. So any advice for parents out there in terms of approaching somebody else that has dealing with post-traumatic stress?
Well, all I can you know, tell you is my experience with that. And my experience with that with my family was always positive. So, and what they did is instead of approach it like a, hey, let's sit down and talk about, essentially talk about what's wrong with you. Instead it was more approached in a, I guess I would recommend coming with just, you know, a lot of love and maybe a little bit of concern. Cause I think the natural thing is, you know, you kind of put barriers up and immediately you kind of feel like, you know, I can see how that can feel like an interrogation if it's not, you know, approached in the right way. But I think if your kid understands that you're coming out of love and concern, that they'll open up on their own. At least that's kind of the way it worked with me. It was, you know, they were so concerned and they were so showing so much love. I kind of felt like, you know, I needed to, you know, besides some of the times where it's just I'm being a drunken maniac and of course we're going to have a conversation at that time, but just talking about it, I think, I think if your kid understands that you're coming from love and concern, that they'll feel like it's a, you know, that they don't feel like they're being, you know, interrogated or attacked in any way, that they'll open up to you. I guess just, yeah.
So
I mean,
so from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, just show some concern and show them a lot of love, and I think they'll open up on their own. Okay. I don't think it's something that you'll have to necessarily pry out of them.
All right. So let me take you to, so you do that, and they don't open up, and you continue to see the behavior. And it gets to a point where it's gotten worse. And you don't want to just, like, open up and be gentle. You want to emphasize how concerned you are.
Yeah, I think it, especially if it's, you know, if it gets to that point, you know, maybe if they realize maybe what it's doing to you, that it's kind of like how Jeremiah said about his drinking, that, you know, he wasn't gonna quit, you know, for himself. you know, it took, I believe he said it was when it was one of his kids, you know, asked if he was sick one morning.
Right.
I think if I got that right.
No, that's a different guy. That's Ross Pape.
Okay.
Do you remember? He's a Army guy, a farmer from Minnesota.
That's right. Yeah, lost his brothers, right?
Yeah, Ross's brothers were both Marines and both killed while on active duty. So, yeah.
Well, him and both Jeremiah, I'm pretty sure, made the comment that, that you know, it wasn't for themselves that they, you know, changed the behaviors. It was for their loved ones that they would do it for.
Right.
So, I think in that situation, if your kid, you know, is not being receptive to the, you know, you trying to be the, you know, to let it happen through compassion kind of route, then maybe if, you know, you have a talk with them about, you know, how you feel and what it's doing to your life, that, maybe it'll click with them that they need to at least start talking about what's wrong.
Interesting. Interesting. Next email. Mac, first of all, where you get these interviews, I don't really know, but you tend not to hear this kind of stuff on too many other stations. Thanks for doing what you do, and thank you to Luke for coming on. The interviews that you've done in the last 48 hours have been awesome. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Question for Luke. How has it affected his relationship with Emma? And I'm specifically interested in the drinking. I have a family member who drinks and is trying to deal with PTSD. Somebody sent me the link to your program, and I've been listening, especially to the stuff you do on PTSD. Liquor is a big part of his problem. What can make somebody stop drinking? Any suggestions, Luke?
Well, to start with the Emma part, I know that she's pretty awesome too, stuck with me through some things she stuck with. I'll go ahead and preface it with that I know that I am absolutely in the minority when it comes to the overall support system I have. I'm beyond fortunate and blessed. So I'm sure that most other women would never have stuck with me. I will say that, and it was about the time that, you know, you told me I need to quit drinking. You know, Emma and I, you know, had a conversation. She's like, you know, Luke, you know, you were getting better with it for a while, but you're starting to, you know, you seem to be losing control with it. And, you know, we had a talk, and that all kind of coincided with this whole, you know, stop drinking thing. And, I'd say it's been great, because the only times that we would ever, you know, argue or anything is when I would, you know, be intoxicated. You know, we get along great, sober. As far as our quality of life, it's great. As far as, you know, a family member that just can't seem to stop drinking, I think there's probably a couple different approaches. I think one, you need to find out, is the person capable of stopping drinking? You know, are they actually, to the point where they're, you know, physically dependent? I think if it's that route, you've got to go professional with, you know, medical help.
Right.
And I'm not really sure, you know, how that process works, but I think if you think the person's incapable of stopping on their own, that you do have to get somebody involved. But if it's somebody who's, like she was saying, dealing with PTSD, I feel like those of us that deal with, you know, trauma and that drink over the trauma, I think very few of us are alcoholics. I think we just drink to try and change how we feel. But if we knew how to cope with it, we wouldn't have a reason to drink, because that's why we do it in the first place.
Hey, let me ask you this.
So I think,
when you and I were talking about your drinking, when I said you need to stop drinking, was there any doubt in your mind that I was right?
I mean, no, there's no doubt that you're wrong. I knew you were right.
Right. Do you think most?
I've been hearing this for a while, but it's a little different when I hear it from a Major Mac. I mean, come on, you know,
come on.
The way it is.
If my kids hear that, they will hate you. If you start getting anonymous hate messages, like, why would you say that to him? Do you understand what you do?
That's fine.
Do you think most guys that drink to change the way they feel, when, if I said that to 100 Marines that are doing that, what percentage do you think know that just their brain just says he's right.
How many percent know that when they hear that, they know that you're right?
Yeah.
I think if we're all being honest with ourselves, and I would say all the Marines in that crowd that are dealing with PTSD, I think the ones that aren't, I think they're like, what does this guy know? Because they're probably, you know, they're drinking for a different reason. They're just partying, doing their thing or whatever. But I think for those that deal with the demons, I think we all know that. It's just something that we all, I think it's just it's just the easy approach when you're feeling that way. And I think, you know, when you're hurting, you grasp for the easy. But I think, yeah, in a crowd of Marines, those that are dealing with trauma and are drinking heavily, they know that's the truth. They know that would help. I don't think you learn that though in annual training when they go down the slides of, you know, how to, you know, drink properly and not get a DUI.
You know what? You're probably right about that. The next question. Mac, I don't mean to pry, but I am interested. When Luke says he was a drinker, how much would he drink? Yeah. And he's from Alabama, too. So when they say they're drinking, it's a lot different than, I mean, when they drink in Alabama, come on, they put on Leonard Skinner, right?
Freebird.
And you guys let it rip, yes?
Yeah. Well, I guess the gun to say, is he talking weekday or weekend? But no.
Okay, let's do that. So weekday drinking. What was weekday drinking?
Weekday drinking, probably about a 12-pack of beer.
In what period of time?
A few hours.
A day?
Yeah, close. I mean, not always 12, but that'd be about, yeah. I mean, you know, you'd build a tolerance after a while, and that seems kind of normal. And then, but the weekend, you know, it'd be, you know, it could be more.
Like, so weekend, what?
Well, not too much different. It'd be more like, because I always drank a little more than I should, for sure. But, as far as if it were a day where I was really, you know, having a crappy day, not, you know, if I maybe, you know, stayed in my apartment all day because I'm feeling like shit or whatever, I might, you know, that evening I might go to the store and, you know, get a fifth of whiskey and, you know, drink most of that. I've definitely, you know,
so a fifth of whiskey maybe, and this would be a lot, and the 12 pack?
That'd be a lot.
Or would it be,
well,
or it's either
or? A fifth of whiskey would be a lot. It'd be either or. Okay. But it'd be usually though as far as whatever code it is for my cage, it typically, 9 times out of 10, it involves drinking liquor. Right. It just does something different to me. And it's not even necessarily a quantity thing. Just when I start drinking liquor, it just unleashes all that shit. And that's been my experience with it.
Here's another email. Mac, please read this to Luke. Luke, do not give Mac any more compliments, okay? Please, the rest of us are begging you. His ego doesn't need it. Please stop right now. Congratulations on the progress that you've made. I can only speak for myself. Almarine Radio is a warm, funny spot for me. It is the Marine Corps. It's my link. And it's a comfortable place that I can go whenever I can get here. I'm happy that your life has turned around so much. Thank you for sharing today. All the best to you, Emma, and your mom and dad for hanging with this. These are the kind of stories that we need more of, and it's going to take all of us reaching out to our battle buddies to make sure that they get the help. But a lot of it, I believe, is peer-to-peer help. And that's what All Marine Radio is. Simply listening to Mike and Mike talk their shit, and then all of a sudden they say something moderately intelligent, it makes you think. I'm just happy that it made you think and your life's pointed in the right direction. Congratulations, bro. Semper Fidelis. The,
Rah,
yeah, exactly. The, so, I mean, Luke, do you see yourself now as somebody who can help other people?
Yeah, I do. And definitely want to start that journey. I think that the number one thing is it's the quit drinking, because I can't, you know, I've done a pretty good job, you know, going back to school.
Okay, hold on.
That and work in order.
So,
but, yeah.
Alabama, you're going to stand up in front of a group and say, stop drinking?
Yeah.
Are you going to get, like, are they going
to, like you say, if you deal.
Are they going to throw, like, chickens and. Exactly.
I'll probably get a spitter to toss at me.
Yeah, they'll fire this song up. And then they start throwing the chickens and tomatoes and, you know, things Southern people carrying around with them all the time. Right? How does that go over in Alabama? Stop drinking. Like, oh, shit, Ellen, we're out of here. You didn't tell me it was going to be this. But it's not. It's, again, same thing with Marine Corps culture. But they know. They know it's true. You knew it was true. And people that are doing it know it's true. You know?
Yep.
And again, I
yep.
think there's tremendous power in the truth. And I think, guys, as you say, guys, they know. They know that they're hiding in alcohol, or they're at least self-medicating with alcohol. And as you said, it starts. I went to sleep. I slept through the night. I wasn't up with my pistol, right, checking doors and shit
yep.
like that. So
right.
if it worked last night, let's do it again. And then pretty soon you look around and it's a 12-pack of beer on in an evening, or a fifth of whiskey on a weekend. And holy shit. But I'm self-medicating, man. This is how I protect myself. This is how I insulate myself from those demons that want to come visit me.
Yeah.
But,
yep.
All right.
And yeah, until that shit jailbreaks, which always, you know, happens at midnight every night, you know, like clockwork. When you're doing that.
All right. Here's one more email, and then I'll let you go. Matt, first of all, thank you for having Luke on today. I would echo what somebody wrote previously. I listened yesterday afternoon to the interview with the Lopez family. Absolutely, positively heartbreaking. They lost their son, and then open mail that said, your PTSD appointment with the VA is the following Tuesday. And then the things that you quoted in the interview made me cry yesterday. When she said that her own baby told her, and you could hear the pain in her voice, say, you won't look at me the same way, you won't love me the same way. It was absolutely heartbreaking. Thank God that Luke, for whatever reason, listened to All Marine Radio and found it. We all need to do a better job to reach out to our battle buddies and share the things that we know to be true that help. And it's not a bag of drugs, and it's not group therapy. It's reconnecting with your battle buddies. It's staying involved in their lives and them staying involved in your lives. It is quitting drinking if you're dealing with this. Maybe someday you can return to a social drinking setting, but I think in the short term while you're dealing with it, you've got to stop. And if you're a heavy drinker, you can never go back there. That's simply part of living a better life. I love the song at the end of your program where you talk about living the high life, because our battle buddies who are killed don't get to live that. We owe that to them, and I believe that's true. Congratulations to Luke. Keep up the good work. Stay on the straight and narrow. It's the path to a greater life. I've heard Max say it, and I'll quote his dumb ass right here. The best things in your life are in front of you. Marriage, raising children, and becoming a member of your community. Luke, you've got a lot to give a community. I think you and Emma will do great things with your lives. You're extremely wise for being such a young guy, and you've come through it all in pretty good shape. Keep working, though. Don't hesitate to ask for help, and all the best. Semper Fidelis, Devil Dog. Luke, how about that?
It was awesome. Simply Dallas.
No, you know what? Again, so many people go down this path. And let me tell you, Bob Nielsen is the patron saint of All Marine Radio. I met him for the first time last week. And he sent me an email afterwards, and he said, I won't read it, but he said, you know, after Vietnam, a lot of us didn't say a whole lot, and there was a lot wrong. And when I heard, and that's, he said, when I saw All Marine Radio, I knew it, what it could be from an experience that you don't have, and that experience was coming home and shutting up, and we went about our business, and everybody ignored us. That was wrong. What All Marine Radio is doing is talking about the issues, talking about the pain, talking about what's wrong, so hopefully we can find solutions to it, and so people can latch on and get help from it. And he said, that's what I saw from the first time I saw this thing. I said, well, you saw it before anybody. And so, I mean, I'll tell you what, it's awful cool that guys like him believe in this. And then you're the beneficiary. And I can't tell you how sad it was for me. And I was thinking about Luke, when I was doing the interview with Carlos and Juanita Lopez. You know, and I'm thinking, why couldn't he have turned on All Marine Radio? Why couldn't he have listened and said, shit, man, I need to give these guys a call. I need to email them. This is my tribe. This is what I need in my life. Why couldn't, you know, but.
You're exactly right. I mean, that's absolutely, I mean, talk about heartbreaking and tragic. What a hard interview to listen to. I mean, it's just awful. I mean, it sounded like the guy, you know, he really had his life on track.
Right. And, he was doing good,
you know,
right?
He was doing great things. Yeah. And it just goes to show that, I mean, you know, it's how awful suicide is and how it just, there's just some times where I guess you just, like all times, it leaves you scratching your head wondering how, I mean, God, it's just heartbreaking. I feel awful for his parents.
No. Well, and I wanted to have you come on today on the heels of that and talk about what it's like to be younger than Mike and I are and what it's like to go through going and looking for help and it not being what you need. And even with the best efforts of the VA, it simply doesn't – you're trying to receive it, but it's simply not what you need. And then you find something someplace else, and it does help. And so I just wanted to bring you on so that we could tell your story and tell people that it's a lot of it's peer-to-peer, it's best practices. But to me, the thing that resonates most with people is that it's the truth. And when somebody tells you the truth, things like you aren't getting over it, things like the best you'll do is coexist with it, things like you've got to stop drinking to deal with it. True, true, true. And I think the reaction is, fucking finally.
Yep.
Fucking finally somebody's telling me the truth. So, Luke, anything that you want people to know that I haven't been smart enough to tell you, ask you?
I think you're setting yourself up for another compliment, so I'm resisting that. No, I can't think of I can't think of anything, Matt. As a, I just appreciate you having me on. Really, I absolutely love this show. I'm extremely proud to be in this house. It's just an All Marine Radio is just the most awesome place, and I really appreciate the show.
You're a tribe, you're a tribal
and all
member,
the people
man.
That are on it. It's all, yeah, it's awesome. Card carrying. Here we go. Turn it up.
Oh my God! Have you ever seen, right? What is it, Jordan Bryant? What's the stadium that University of Alabama plays in?
Bryant Denny.
Bryant Denny.
I went to school there. I don't know. Yeah, Bryant Denny. Yeah. I don't know who Denny is, but we know who Bear is.
The Denny family is big around Birmingham. My dad managed, and the Denny family, big stuff down there, man.
Okay, all right. Well, that's where it comes from.
There you go.
Matt, give me some Alabama history.
Exactly. But if you ever see these hillbillies, when this song comes on, how would you describe that? This is their, like, defiant, we're from Alabama, fuck you, and we're going to kick your ass in football right now. Is it, yes? Yeah. Is that a fair, like, all the hillbillies get fired up, they got their Bear Bryant hats on, they're jumping all over the place?
The whole damn town's roaring. Oh, yeah. Tits are out, you know, people screaming. It's wild.
There you have it. All right, Luke from Alabama, fiancé of Emma, son of Libby. What's your dad's name? He's anonymous in all this.
He's Luther.
Luther and Luke. Those are Alabama names. And normally they have hair down to the middle of their back. Hi, my name's Luther. Whoa, hey, Luther, what's up? Got a few shotguns in that pickup? I do. A couple handguns, too. You want to see them? Anyway. All right, man. Thanks for the visit. Give my best to Emma, and I hope you don't mind. We'll drag you back on now that you've been on, and when we need your expertise, don't be surprised.
All right, sure thing, Matt.
All right, bud. Have a good day. Thank you.
All right. Semper Fi.
There you go. Semper Fidelis. Luke. Oh, my God. If you've never seen it, check it out. Just do a search on YouTube. University of Alabama, Sweet Home Alabama. Just when you thought civilization was making some progress. Yeah, so you see them. You see them, right? And I think they played at the same time every week. And you hear this. And, like, pandemonium ensues. So they're all standing around, and here it comes. Oops. I screwed it up. Sorry about that. I gave it that big setup, and I screwed up the audio. That irritates me. Yeah, they hear this. And they all yell, turn it up, too. It is a great beginning, though. I'm not gonna lie to you. And then they go ahead and they kick your ass in football. Luther, man. That's a straight-up Southern name. That a Southern man don't need him around anyhow. Don't ask me how I know it. And the governor's true. All right, that'll do it. That'll do it on a Wednesday, hump day. Almarine Radio. My thanks to Luke for coming on and doing this. My thanks to Carlos Lopez Sr. and his wife, Juanita, for coming on yesterday. If you haven't heard that interview, you should listen to it. But I want to have Luke on to talk about the different demons that a young guy deals with. And then you go down to the VA, and I think you get their standard. There's a lot of people, and Mike and I say this all the time as a disclaimer, there's a lot of people that are down there that are doing the best they can. But I would tell you that if I could give you the most oft heard thing I hear from veterans is, I don't want to be a zombie. Right? I don't want the bag of drugs and to go to group. I want somebody that can help me. And I will tell you, I think that the best helpers are our peers. And I wish the VA had a very lucrative program where guys would say, hey, man, check it out. I work for VA Mental Health. Oh, you do? Yeah, I make a lot of money. I help a lot of people. And it's good. In the meantime, be an evangelist. And again, it's not just, it's anybody with trauma. Reach out and help them. Because I guarantee you, I mean, we're a little bit more coarse, you know? That's an understatement. You know, this is a rough and tumble organization, and so at the end of the day, a lot of times we're not afraid to say. We're not afraid to speak the truth. And so, I can guarantee you if they're civilians, they get the whole sugar-coated thing and all of that. Yeah. Question is, do civilians respond to that blunt truth like Marines do? I can tell you from Botox Girl, the answer to that, my limited experience with my sister, with Botox Girl, who else? Another friend's mom that I've had these kind of conversations with, and probably more if I sat down and thought about it, you know, all kinds of people. The truth resonates with people. The truth resonates with people. And most people are stronger than they think, and they're capable of more than they know. But I think it's confusing and it's disheartening when people, you know, want to pump you full of drugs and your time isn't productive, and it's frustrating, and I think most people move away from it. All right, so whatever you do, don't touch that dial. In the first hour, you'll hear some news, some breaking news out of Afghanistan. You'll also hear me do a little commentary about the Catholic Church. Memo to Pope Francis, okay? Get rid of the celibacy shit, all right? It hurts your institution. Can you imagine if some of the great leaders, and I say this as a Catholic, that I know in the military would consider a life as a leader in the Catholic Church, right? If they could have their family? You don't get those people now. You should open it up to women as well. Get the best people to lead the church, and you'll be surprised at the renaissance that happens in the Catholic Church. There's nothing wrong with the philosophy of the Catholic Church. As I said before, people might quabble with political stances relative to abortion and stuff. That's fine. Then it's not for you. But the Catholic Church has a crisis of human resources, artificially imposed. So, Francis, right? Get your shit together. Get your pen out. Do away with that. There you have it. Advice for the church right here. Boom! We share a name. Francis. Get it together. Have a great day. On a Wednesday, Almarine Radio. Out.